charge into the room.
I'd like to call to order the May 4 meeting of the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. Clerk, would you take the roll, please?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Vice Chair Shemansky?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Kreisel? Representative Lane?
Here.
Representative Lesh?
Here.
Representative Liebling?
Here.
Representative Mazerall?
Here.
Representative Moline?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Present.
Representative Wardlow?
Present.
Chair notes that we do have a quorum, so the first item on the agenda would be a consideration of the minutes from May 3rd, 2011. Can I have a motion on that? Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes from May 3rd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Minutes are adopted and approved, rather. We're going to take up the bills on the calendar in the order that they're there, and I'll just, for your information, members, we're going to entertain a motion on 1535, Representative Cornish's first bill, motion to pass, and re-refer to Ways and Means. The next two bills, House File 770 and 654, will be heard this morning and laid over. The final bill, House File 1467, Cornish Bill on Firearms, we will entertain a motion that it pass and be sent to the General Register. We do have a room for this evening. However, it's the Chair's intent, and we will conclude our business this morning. All right, Representative Cornish. I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on your motion on Representative Cornish's 1467, I have had conversations with the interested parties, and as the bill is right now, I believe that it would have a fiscal note, and so there may be some amendments to take those things out. But just for your awareness, Mr. Chair, for example, there's a report that would be due by the Commissioner of Health, which would be a health issue. There's also some civil law language in the bill. And so just so you're aware, Mr. Chair, that if those amendments aren't done, there'll be a motion to re-refer it somewhere else.
Very good. I may have misspoken. I think we'll entertain a motion that be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. All right. Representative Cornish, what can I do for you?
Okay. Chair, have you already moved my bill? Or do you want me to?
You go ahead.
And it's going to
re-referred to Ways and Means, so if you present the motion.
I would like to move House File 1535 be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means.
Representative Cornish, I recognize you. Go ahead with the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a...
Before you start, excuse me, is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard in testimony on this bill? Raise your hand now. Anyone wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand now. Okay, one. All right. Just wanted to see what kind of time frame we need here. Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1535 is basically a bill to do with forfeiture, standardization, simplification, and reporting. And changes have been brought to me by the County Attorneys Association. And without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier to explain the bill, if I could, sir.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingry, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I will certainly take your guidance and be brief this morning. As this bill has been described by the groups that have worked on it, as you know from last session, many of you that were here, this is a controversial area. This is what we would characterize as a non-controversial bill in a controversial area. It's been worked on by the Criminal Institute for Justice, the Minnesota Association of Defense Attorneys, the American Civil Liberties Union, and our association. Our association has endorsed this bill. Essentially what this does is it takes the changes that were made to our forfeiture laws last year in controlled substances and moves them to DWI and two off-the-road incidences. It clarifies the notice requirement. There were some changes last year to the notice requirement. This even simplifies it more. We believe with these changes, the law enforcement person on the street will be able to use one forfeiture form rather than the three forms that they currently have to use. We also believe that it'll be in a process that'll be easier to understand for those individuals who have had their property seized and subject to forfeiture. If the property is under $15,000, they can go to conciliation court, which is, I think many of you know, is a much easier process to put your claim out. We have discussed this with three courts in St. Louis County, Hennepin and Ramsey County, and the conciliation court individuals there had said as a result of the changes last year, they've seen no appreciable increase in their volume, and they didn't expect any with this. Obviously, there'll be some increase, but they didn't expect it to be significant. One other change that we make from last year, as you know, there was a prohibition on selling a property that was subject to forfeiture, a prohibition against selling it to law enforcement or their employees or family members. We expand that to prosecutors as well. We figure what's good for law enforcement is good for prosecutors as well. So prosecutors or their families or loved ones would not be able to purchase this at auction. And with that, and members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Members, any questions from the committee for Mr. Kingery? Any questions? All right, let's take additional. I'm sorry, Representative Champion, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I notice, or I believe that I saw in this bill, that if a person is convicted of a crime, that the property is automatically forfeited, and if that's not right, please correct me. And the second part of my question is, if that's true on the conviction side, do you have any language that would speak to whether a person's property should be returned automatically if they are not charged with a crime?
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the provision in the bill that you're referring to simply clarifies and reorganizes that part of the statute. It does not make any substantive changes to our forfeiture statutes. Before property is forfeited, it is reviewed by the county attorney, or in this case the prosecutor, because it could be city attorneys as well. That was one of the changes that was put in the statute last year. So before it is forfeited, it is reviewed for final determination by the prosecutor. Also, there's a provision in here for remission and mitigation. So a person can petition the county attorney or the prosecutor in this case to state their case why it should not be subject to forfeiture. So there are two protections that are in there that I believe address those issues.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, so to the testifier, if an individual wants to petition the prosecuting authority, how might that be done? Is that a formal petition where there would be a filing fee? Or is it just a letter that is sent to the prosecuting authority saying, I want my property returned?
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that was language that was put in last year's bill. And it's, if I recall, I think the language just says they can petition. There's no filing fee. It's a direct communication with the prosecutor. It does not go through the court process, so there's no filing fee.
Representative Champion, anything else?
One last question.
Go right ahead.
One last question. To the testifier. So even though there was no substantive change the law, if House File Number 1535 is passed, can you tell me what the thoughts of the key stakeholders had around whether there should be an automatic return of property taken if a person is not charged with a crime?
Dangray.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that was not part of our discussion. We did not review that this year.
Any further, Representative Champion?
For the sake of time, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to.
I'm not asking you to make up more questions.
Although I do have some additional questions.
All right. Anyone else of this testifier? All right. Next witness, please. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor.
There's a provision in Section 24 that requires some additional work for my staff, and so I wanted to stop by today. It could entail a fiscal note, and so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I'm trying to work with the author and some other folks on this, because I think there's a way to get this done that doesn't cost anything, and that's my favorite way to go when possible, because I know there's no money right now with the state. So we'll see if we can't get that ironed out. But the way it's drafted currently, it will create some additional work for my staff. And right now they work full-time and then some just to get their current work done. So it'd be difficult for us to absorb that.
Any questions of the witness, of the testifier? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to be heard on this bill, come forward. Otherwise, I'll close testimony. And Representative Cornish.
I've had a request from the sponsors of the bill to delete Section 24. Is that correct? And that would take care of the concern here. So Mr. Kingery, you want to?
You want to be heard on that, Mr. Kingery?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no.
All right.
Thank you.
Good.
Representative Cornish, then you want to move to delete Section 24 on page 21, et cetera. Is that correct?
That'd be correct.
We'll, we'll consider that an author's motion. Representative Cornish.
And would this allow it to go to the floor then instead of Ways and Means? It would take the fiscal out of it?
Let's ask the fiscal analyst for an opinion on that.
Mr. Chair and members, I do believe that this would take care of any costs that are in here. I'll look over it a little bit more, but I think that there should be no fiscal impact if Section 24 is removed.
All right. On the Representative Cornish's author's amendment to delete Section 24, any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Cornish, renew and revise your motion.
I would like to move that House File 1535, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the General Register.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Masrall, House File 770. Representative Masrall, if you'd move your bill to get it before the committee, and then it would be my intention to lay it over. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 770 to be laid over. Mr. Chair, members, this bill has passed through the Civil Law Committee. It amends Minnesota Statute Section 549.09 relating to prejudgment interest. The statute currently provides for interest based upon the one-year Treasury bill where the amount of the judgment or award is $50,000 or less. And the current law provides that prejudgment interest is 10% if the judgment or award is over $50,000. This bill would change the over $50,000 calculation to be the one-year Treasury bill rate plus 8 points. This provides for a float and reduces the current 10% flat interest rate, which is currently out of market. And I have with me Mr. Bob Johnson to testify.
Very good, Representative Masrall. Before you begin with your testimony, is there anyone in this room who wants to be heard on this bill, either for or against? Raise your hand now, please. All right, keep them up. I see three to my left, nobody to the right. All right, go ahead. Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here today as a board member for Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. And we just want to briefly comment, Mr. Chairman. We've had the opportunity to testify on this bill. And really just a couple of minutes on Minnesota public policy and Minnesota law. A lot of times when bills like this come before the committee, and including myself, we talk about what other states are doing and X number of states are doing this and X number doing that. I'd like to just focus on Minnesota public policy. And 2 years ago, this legislature decided to change our prejudgment interest statute, the statute 549.09, to change from the then standard, which was this one-year T-bill rate or 4% as a floor. We couldn't go below that. And made the decision to increase it for judgments over $50,000 to a fixed 10%. So with that decision, and we didn't support it, our predecessor organization to Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform did not support that. Then that was 2 years ago. Last year, this legislature acted on that same statute and made the decision for units of government in Minnesota as a matter of public policy to go back to the old rate. And in my opinion, and being here and observing, I believe it was done because of the costs to government. The 10% was a higher rate. So the public policy decision was to move government back to that old standard, keeping the private standard sector at the fixed 10%. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, our organization, which is 58,000 plus employers in this state, believe that as a matter of public policy, and as the bill is introduced, and I know it's not in that form right now, our request was to put the private sector at the same rate that this legislature decided to put the public sector at. So as a matter of public policy for Minnesota, if that was the right decision for government, that should be the same decision for the private sector. So, Mr. Chairman, I know this bill, it's different than that. And it does move the public sector rate slightly. We have concerns about the rate as it sits in the bill right now, which reintroduces a variability to that rate for judgments over $50,000 by adding the 8% on top of that T-bill rate. And we know that T-bill rate today is what, 0.26%. It's a quarter of 1%. But on a going forward basis, if you dialed back 5 years or so, I think that T-bill rate might have been 6%. So we're really not interested in seeing the Minnesota rate, you know, go back to 14% or some higher rate. So, Mr. Chairman, I know this bill's going to be laid over, and I appreciate that we are committed to, as a matter of public policy, readdressing the decision that was made in 2 years ago to go to a fixed 10%. And whatever other states are doing, we think if that's the public policy in Minnesota, that government should be at the low rate, then the private sector should not be at a higher rate than government is at. So I'll stop with that, Mr. Chairman, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any member of the committee have questions for this witness? Representative Lesh, then Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm a little slow this morning, Mr. Johnson, so you might have to help me out. So you're going to increase the rate at which government pays out, but there's no fiscal impact. I can't follow. Can you explain that to me?
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah, I mean, our position, House File 77 as introduced, did not do that. House File 770 as introduced moved the private sector to the current government rate.
Oh, I'm following you. Okay. Thank you.
That was the development.
Very good. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Mr. Johnson, Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, who you're here representing, I guess, as a board member, I'm just wondering who that is. Who funds that group? Who's a member of it?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I know a sheet has been handed out to this committee, to the Civil Law Committee, with a roster of all of the trade associations, the chambers of commerce, the individual entities. Funding comes from a multitude of groups within that group. It is not, as some have described it, as an insurance-based organization. I'm a board member. Tom Hesse is a board member of the Minnesota Chamber. Mike Hickey of the National Federation of Independent Business is a board member. And John Hausladen of the Minnesota Trucking Association is a board member. So it's 58,000, again, many trade associations and many chambers of commerce are formal members of the organization.
Any further questions? Anyone else have questions? Let's move on to additional testimony. Whoever raised their hand, step forward. We've got three witnesses or three testifiers. Try to keep your testimony to 4 or 5 minutes, sir. Thank you. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Also joining me is Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Inter-County Association. Let me first state that we are working with Representative Mazerall on the bill. As it was introduced, as Mr. Johnson indicated, this had no impact on units of government. As amended in the Civil Law Committee, this really basically undoes what was done last year and signed into law by Governor Pawlenty that really restored the interest rate on prejudgment interest for local units of government to 4%, the greater of 4%, or the one-year treasury yield. So we'd like to really try to go back to the original intent of the law change last year. This will have a fiscal impact on local units of government. It will have a fiscal impact, I believe, on the state of Minnesota. I haven't talked with anybody at the state about that yet. So basically, we'd like to continue to work with Representative Mazerall to try to fix the changes made in civil law so that it does carve out local units of government back to the law change in 2010.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I will not go over what Mr. Carlson just said other than to emphasize that counties also oppose this bill in its current form. We were supportive of it as it was introduced. I do want to emphasize that the interest rate increase goes both ways for judgments for and against the state or local governments on judgments over $50,000. So any judgment we get against a business or an individual over $50,000, that interest rate will more than double from the current 4% to about 8.25% based on the current one-year treasury rate. Again, we are against this legislation as it's currently amended.
Any questions of either of these witnesses, members? Thank you. Next witness, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Carey, I'm the president of MAJ, and we, of course, like the laws that originally it was before this session, Mr. Chairman. We are certainly willing and will continue to work with people to find something that's equitable for consumers and for litigants in the state. The present amendment of a floating rate of 8% is obviously much more desirable in our view than a fixed rate of 4%. The purpose of the interest statute is to give incentive to resolve claims, to give a disincentive to appeal claims. A rate of 4% accomplishes neither of those things. So, Mr. Chairman, having said that, and I've testified on this issue before, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Any questions of Mr. Carey? Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson for the Association of Justice. Just briefly on two points, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your efforts to increase the post-judgment interest rate. It was your legislation that got us to the point we're at today, and I appreciate you doing it. Want you to know that the interest rate that you changed at 4%, which is the bill that was introduced, is the lowest in the country. 4% is the lowest in the country. There isn't anyone that low. All of our surrounding neighbors are either 10% or higher. So the 10% rate was a mid-range, and we appreciated the legislature's support on doing that. I also want you to know, as it relates to local units of government, we worked with them because what they were concerned about had nothing to do with injury judgments or settling claims. They have some very lengthy proceedings relative to tax court and to eminent domain proceedings. And they convinced us that the interest rate on those judgments against them, which sometimes were not in their control but were the landowners pursuing claims through the eminent domain process, that leaving their rate at 4% or floating was equitable for them. And we also base that on the fact that you need to know that governments enjoy significant statutory immunity. They have caps on their damages. They are completely different than the insured negligent claims that are often subject to this interest rate. So we think the bill is a significant improvement from where it was introduced. I don't want to say we support the work of the Civil Law Committee, but we certainly feel that they've made substantial progress to improving the bill and not moving that rate down, so that we will go back to the lowest in the country and have a disincentive for litigants to settle their claims. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any questions of either one of these two witnesses? If not, next witness.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Identify yourself and proceed, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stephen Baker, the assessor for Ramsey County and a member of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers and current vice president of that group. I guess what I'd just like to add, I think, just to correct, you know, one thing, I think the rate here is not a fixed rate. It is a floating rate to the extent that it's 8% on top of whatever the bond rate is. So I think the first testifier has correctly said that, you know, 5 years ago that would have meant we would have had, what, a 13 or 14% rate. Assessors worked hard last session to try to correct what we thought was, where we just got swept up in the legislation from 2009, and, you know, particularly our tax court settlements. Ramsey County right now, we just ended another filing period, so I don't know exactly what our total petitions are. We were at about $7 billion under petition prior to this year's filings, which mostly came in the last 2 weeks. We're probably at about $11 billion under appeal right now. That's near record numbers. We do not control the timing of the settlements. We've had settlements wait as long as 6 years after we had agreed upon resolution before the stipulations were signed by the petitioning party. So we strongly feel that having the interest rate that is caused to pay on judgments over $50,000 on tax petitions is not good policy, and will definitely lead to significant increases in local government costs, and to the extent that the state has to reimburse the school districts, which are party to these claims, there will be a state cost as well.
Any questions from the members of this committee of this witness? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Final witness, I believe we have one more. Any further testimony? All right. We'll close the testimony. Representative Mazerol.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the testimony that's been brought forward both for and against this bill. The impact to local governments is a consequence of amendment that came up in civil law, and it is my intention, Mr. Chair and members, to continue to work as this bill is laid over with the local government representatives.
Very good. Thank you. Hearing no further questions, Chair lays the bill over. Thank you. All right, House File 654, Representative Wardlow. And the Chair will entertain a motion from Representative Wardlow to House File 654 that it be recommended to pass and placed on the general register, and it'll be my intent to not vote and lay it over. Go ahead, Representative Wardlow. The bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 654 regards statute of limitations. It would change the general statute of limitations for a number of actions listed under 54105 from 6 years to 4 years. The idea being that statute of limitations at 6 years is generally too long given the public policy considerations for statutes of limitations that date all the way back to, I think, 1858. Statute of limitations, as you may know, prescribe the period within which cause of action can be brought. They don't have anything to do with the rights that a person has, but rather they prescribe the time within which the remedy is available. And statute of limitations have a general purpose of allowing potential defendants to have repose, or rather to have comfort from anxiety and worry that potential litigation might be out there after a period of time has passed and are fundamental to our system of justice. And we need this to improve Minnesota's business climate and help create jobs so that potential defendants don't have to worry about litigation risks and can more certainly calculate with more certainty potential litigation risks for engaging in particular kinds of business or engaging in particular kinds of transactions. And with that, I will have Dale Thorne's Joe here.
Good morning. Before you begin, is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on this bill in testimony? Raise your hand now. I'm counting two. Very good. Sir, state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thorne's Joe. I'm a litigator and trial lawyer in the Minneapolis area. Been a member of the bar of the state of Minnesota for well over 25 years, handling a variety of contract and tort claims over the years, both in this state and in other jurisdictions. I'm a member of the federal and state bars and their related associations, as well as the Defense Research Institute, which is an international organization of attorneys which defend the interests of businesses and individuals in civil litigation. I'm also a member of the local arm of the DRI, which is the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here on behalf of the MDLA to support House File 654. It is also noted that the business community, including the Chambers of Commerce, both nationally and in the state, also support this bill. As Representative Wardlow indicated, this is addressing a limitation of actions to reduce the general contract, tort, and statutory causes of action from 6 years to 4 years. This does not address specific exceptions that the legislature has addressed involving public policy matters such as sexual abuse, such as medical malpractice. There are a variety of other statutes of limitations which are not impacted by this bill. These are the general default statutes of limitations. And as Representative Wardlow indicated, these have been in place since 1858. And that may seem to imply that this is a well-tested and well-appreciated statute of limitations. But it really is the obligation of the legislature to reassess and address whether or not legislation that has been or laws that have been in effect for a long time are appropriate, given the evolution of the day and the age of what our society is in this day and age. Frankly, if the reasoning is that the bill was enacted in 1858 and therefore we should keep it, well then we should take a look at the other laws that were passed in 1858 and perhaps keep those, such as requiring a husband to be sued as part of a lawsuit if his wife is sued. Clearly the public policies have changed. The realities of the time have changed. 1858 is a time when you're traveling by riverboat, you're traveling by stagecoach, you're traveling by horse. You can't find a defendant in order to sue them. You need a certain length of time in order to identify an individual, make sure that you have witnesses available, and make sure that you can then bring your cause of action. As everyone knows, in the internet age, when fax machines came, it was now down to 3 days to return a call. When it came down to the internet and email, now we're talking literally in minutes. The passage of years is really now almost the equivalent of dog years. And so if you have a 6-year statute of limitations, it really in the reality of life is almost like 42 years. It just does not make sense anymore in this day and age to allow a cause of action to languish for as long as 6 years when the person is aware of that cause of action and then chooses not to exercise their right. This proposed legislation does not change the other dynamics that are involved with statutes of limitations. For example, if a discovery rule is applied in a certain situation, this change does not alter whether or not a discovery rule is applied for the commencement of a cause of action. It continues to be that the accrual of any cause of action is at a point in time in which a motion to dismiss would be defeated. That is, in a tort situation where you have duty, breach, causation, and damages. So this bill does not change those other dynamics that are involved with statutes of limitations. This really does reflect a public policy of trying to create a neutral playing ground for litigants both plaintiffs and defendants. 6 years can be a long passage of time. A lot of people, I always say, I can't remember what I had for lunch last week. How to ask someone 5, 6 years ago what it was that happened with a particular conversation, what it was that happened, how the evidence was 5 or 6 years ago. A great example of this was Senator Jungbauer in the Senate Judiciary Committee talked about the fact that he operates a small business, septic system business, and he was sued on the last day of a 6-year statute of limitation case. And when they went out to the site to address the issues that were involved with the lawsuit, what they found was that the site conditions had radically changed in just the few years prior to the commencement of the lawsuit. In other words, there was not a fair and accurate way to assess the evidence that was in effect at the time of the event in order to allow a fair and on the facts and on the merits resolution of the case. What a reduction of the statute of limitations to 4 years would do would to be encouraging a resolution on the merits, on the facts, as opposed to mere happenstance. It just doesn't seem right that the public policy of this state should be that the luck of the draw of how evidence is remaining or how a remembrance happens should be the public policy of the state. This brings the law in Minnesota more in line with other jurisdictions as well. There are 42 states across the country that have statutes of limitations for tort that are 3 years or less. This would reduce the general statute to 4 years. So we would still technically be outside the mainstream across the country, but be more in line. The same is also true with matters such as statutory causes of action. 32 other jurisdictions have statutes of limitations for consumer fraud that are 3 years or less. This would bring this more in line with across the country. It would also bring more uniform in line with the strict liability statute of 4 years, as well as the Uniform Commercial Code breach of warranty statute within 4 years.
Let's go to questions from the committee. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the testifier, would you tell me your name again, sir?
Dale Farnsjoe.
Mr. Farnsjoe.
T-H-O-R-N-S-J-O.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I remember that now. Thank you. Mr. Farnsjoe, do you agree with the author that passage of this would enhance a job climate in Minnesota?
Mr. Thornstra.
Mr. Chairman, Member Lesh, I believe that it would simply because from a practical standpoint, when I have been counseling businesses in various jurisdictions, one of the things that they ask me is, what's your statute of limitations? What's your general statute of limitations?
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Thornstra, more importantly, I think, this having been in place since statehood and the status quo being a little bit antiquated, do you anticipate that after the passage of this, that Minnesota would have more jobs than it did at statehood?
I don't think that that's a valid question.
Oh,
given what
Mr.
we have,
gentlemen,
simply
the chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Member Lesh. Obviously, the number of people that were in the state in 1858 versus the number of people in the state today makes that question relative. Perhaps what you're asking is, do I anticipate that if this is enacted, would this create a more positive business climate in Minnesota? And I do think that that would be the situation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Thornstra. Well, you use a lot of words to answer, so I know you're an attorney, but just to let you know, Mr. Thornstra, that's the kind of logic we use around here, so you're going to have to take issue with a lot of members arguing about the budget right now. So, no, that's absolutely the way we use it. Mr. Thornstra, how many jobs do you think will be created if we pass this? And let me ask, how many jobs will be created if we reduce it from 4 to 2, and say if we reduced it commensurately from 6 to 4, say we reduced it to just 2 and 1 instead of 4 and 2. How many more jobs would we get if we reduced it to those numbers?
Mr. Thornstra.
Mr. Chairman, Member Lesh, I'm a trial lawyer. I'm not an economist. And what I am here to talk about is the judiciary public policy involving this bill. That would be something that is not beyond or is beyond my particular expertise. I can give you anecdotal information about how businesses and individuals perceive the climate in Minnesota based on a six-year statute of limitation.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could ask the author then, Representative Wardlow, how many jobs would you anticipate would be yielded from the way the bill is written, and then how many more would we yield if we reduced it even more?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lash. Obviously, it's impossible to quantify exactly how many jobs would be created and or saved by this legislation, but there is a point, I suppose, with statute of limitations, as with anything else, that would be optimal for the business climate in general. Right now, the six-year statute of limitations is outside the optimal range. Coming down to 4 years will improve the business climate simply by logically speaking. If you create a climate where potential litigants or defendants have the certainty that they won't have to defend stale claims in court when witnesses have passed away, moved away, evidence has been lost, and there isn't a way to determine their case based on the facts, if they don't have to face that kind of uncertainty, it helps them make a decision to come to Minnesota to start a business here, to expand a business here, because there are more certainty with regard to risks, and there is less risk of those kinds of things out there for them to face, reducing the cost of doing business in Minnesota. So that necessarily will create jobs, looking at that factor alone.
Representative Lash, do you have a final question?
No, I do not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Maylene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, Mr. Thorns. Joe, maybe you had stated this, but I don't recall hearing it. How this past year, for example, how many civil actions were commenced between the 4 and 6 year mark?
Mr. Thornstra.
Mr. Chair, Member Moline, I have not compiled specific numbers of what the impact may be on the judiciary of a reduction of the statute of limitations between or from 6 down to 4 years. I do believe that there are cases out there. Senator Youngbowers is a classic example of that. I have handled similar cases that have been brought in those 5 and 6 years that have suffered the problems that we've talked about.
Representative Maylene.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I guess since this bill is designed to supposedly improve the business climate, it would be nice to know what the actual impact was on the business community to see how many actions were commenced between the 4 and 6 year mark, so maybe you could get that to the committee.
Very good. I have...
Mr. Chair, I do
I'm
have
sorry.
One more.
Go
I have
right.
one more question.
Representative Maylene.
To Mr. Thorns, Joe, you had stated in your opening comments that this wasn't going to affect sexual assault cases and others, but I'm looking at the second page of the bill, and lines 2.4 to 2.6 say, for assault, battery, false imprisonment, or other tort resulting in personal injury, if the conduct that gives rise to the cause of action also constitutes domestic abuse. So could you explain that to me, please?
Mr. Thornsville.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moline, my statement was sexual abuse, not sexual assault. There is a separate statute of limitations in Minnesota for a 6 year statute of limitations for sexual abuse. The sexual assault provision that you reference at the very end of it involves domestic relations. Yes, it would reduce that from 6 to 4 years. But the public policy that is being advocated by this reduction from 6 to 4 years is to encourage people to resolve their issues and resolve their differences. And that is, if this reduction creates an issue with regard to domestic abuse situations, then it is something that the legislature can address in a separate exception to a general statute of limitations.
Representative Maylene, I apologize. And Mr. Thornstro, she's a state representative, not a state senator.
And I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I guess my only comment to what you just said is I hope that children and women are able to resolve their sexual assaults within a 4 year limit under this bill.
Very good. Now, we do have two other representatives, Champion and Johnson. I would kind of like to get the additional testimony out of the way, and if you have a question of this witness, we'll call him back. So, additional testimony? Did I see two hands? Sir, come forward. State your name and go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Carey again here on behalf of MAJ. Mr. Chairman, there's a long history behind this bill, and I want to remind everyone that civil litigation in this state is down 40%, that the amount of jury verdicts is down, the dollar value of jury verdicts is down, that we're 30th in the country in automobile insurance premiums, and at least I have no evidence that there's some huge influx of cases that are occurring in the 4 to 6 year period. So we oppose any change in the statute of limitations. We don't see any reason for it. We think the system is working very, very well. And the states that do have a shorter statute of limitations often have a discovery rule, Mr. Chairman, and we would ask that be considered. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, give us your name again and go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
I'm sorry, Representative Wardle.
We would be willing to look at language if it was brought forward.
Is there an amendment? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, there was an amendment in the Civil Law Committee. I think happy to review that language with Representative Wardlow and the committee. It was not offered in the Civil Law Committee, but we'd be happy to discuss that here.
All right. We will be laying this bill over, so it's not a matter of weeks. It's a matter of hours, so get moving on that, all right? Any questions? Go ahead.
I think, Mr. Chair, the amendment has been delivered to your committee administrator from the Civil Law Committee.
All right. Any questions? Representative Champion, did you have a question?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson? Any other questions? Any other testimony?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Carlson. I'm not overlooking you. I'm just trying to move us along.
And I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. No one has mentioned yet what is the this is the optimal time for business. No one's talked about what's the optimal time for the person who's been injured or wronged. You know, that sexual assault victim, and I work with a lot of them, they're not ready necessarily to bring their cause of action into court in 4 years. They're not through with their divorce. They're not healed. They're not ready to confront their accuser. The six-year statute of limitation has not worked to a disadvantage to anyone. And I'd like to make sure that the committee understands that lowering the statute of limitations in many of the causes of action that are in the bill bring us out of line with other states, in particular as it relates to contracts. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence. There was a witness who contacted me that wanted to testify tomorrow who had a medical emergency that couldn't get here today, and I appreciate you indulging him tomorrow. But just on written contracts, you just need to know that that we would be coming now one of the lowest in the country, and Alabama, Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, all six, Georgia, Hawaii, six, Illinois and Indiana, Iowa, 10, Kentucky, 15 years, the statute of limitations on written contracts. We're going now down to 4 under this bill. Louisiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, all 6. You get that most states are longer than the 4-year statute of limitations for written contracts that are in this proposal, and we think that that is bad. You know, I read in the paper over the weekend, maybe you caught it, that Thrivent Financial brought a claim this week, was announced this week, to recover for the damage that happened to them during the stock market collapse. Their claim goes back to 2005. And their claim to recoup their losses from those who had done them harm would be barred under this bill. So their chance to recover for their retirees would be barred. We think that that's
Mr. Chair,
wrong.
Representative Wardlow.
I'm not certain whether that particular case, I haven't read the contracts involved in that case. I don't even know what kind of cause of action it was in particular. So I don't think it's appropriate for us to base our decisions or discuss the particulars of that case with regard to the statute of limitations, because I'm not certain it would have been barred.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Carl.
I'm happy to provide the article that was in the Star Tribune. My point isn't that that case would be barred. My point is that moving forward, if this were the law, those causes of action would be time barred. I didn't suggest that that claim would be dismissed under this bill. That those kinds of cases would be time barred. And you know, in the Insurance Journal yesterday, there was an article about the top 10 risks facing business leaders. It was a study done by an insurance risk group. I'm happy to provide this to the committee, but nowhere is litigation even in the top 10. It's not the number one thing that they testified in the civil law committee. The number one thing they ask us is, what's the statute of limitations? That's nonsense. I represent business. They don't ask that. They want to know about the job market. They want to know about transportation, water, power. Litigation is certainly, and exposure to risk is certainly a concern, but it's not even in the top 10. It is certainly a concern, but it's not in the top 10. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill benefits no Minnesotan unless you're an insurance company. That's the only people that benefit from this. We cut off their exposure 2 years earlier, and they are the only one that benefits from that. We do not see any premium reduction. Businesses do not see any premium reduction. And that's why this right that we've had since statehood, we feel you should defend and not take away from Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wardlaw, really I'm trying to get a handle on what the purpose of the bill is, or what the need for the bill is. Do you have any specific examples where memory has been a problem in the fifth and sixth year where that's
Representative
made it more difficult to resolve the litigation?
Excuse me. Representative Wardlaw.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, Mr. Thornsjoe did bring up one example. Where the statute of limitations in general, not with regard to the memories of people, but with regard to evidence having disappeared because site conditions had changed, was a problem. And one can think of a multitude of ways that this could be a problem out past year four, where memories would fade. You know, I can hardly remember what I had for lunch yesterday. It would take me a moment to figure that out, let alone what I had for lunch 6 years ago on the particular day. And when you get into court cases, oftentimes little things like that matter. And so 6 years is a long time, and times have changed since 1858, so it's time for this statute of limitations to change as well.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I appreciate that, but you don't have any specific cases. I understand the general your general presentation, but you don't have any specific cases where it's really created a problem.
I'm
Representative Wardle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I am certain there are many specific cases where it has created a problem. I do not have a list for you at this time, and it would be very difficult to compile such a list.
Any other questions from any member of the committee? Mr. Carey.
Thank you. Just briefly, I've been a trial lawyer for 24 years, Mr. Chairman, and the number of cases that are put into suit in the fourth to sixth year, I don't have accurate statistics. I don't even have them for myself, but I can tell you they're rare. And that's not a reason to limit the right. That's a reason to congratulate ourselves for having a good system that works. Just because a claim is stale doesn't mean it's not legitimate. People aren't sitting around on their hands saying, I know I have a legitimate claim, but I'm going to take my time making that claim simply because I know I'm in Minnesota and I have 6 years and not 4 years. There are good reasons those people don't bring those claims until the fourth, fifth, or sixth year. There is no huge influx of cases that have been filed in the fourth, fifth, and sixth year. I can tell you that with absolute certainty.
Any other questions from the committee? All right, Chair lays the bill over.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wardle, excuse
me. If I might, in the words of the United States Supreme Court in 1945, Chase Securities Corporation for Donaldson, just talking about statutes of limitation in general, they said they are practical and pragmatic devices to spare the courts from litigation of stale claims, and the citizen from being put to his defense after memories have faded, witnesses have died or disappeared, and evidence has been lost. They go to matters of remedy, not to destruction of rights. I think that is what we're talking about here, so we should not lose sight of that. Also, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the State Chamber of Commerce both support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't know what our rebuttal rule is here, but I kind of like to close with the author having the last word.
Well,
Mr. Carlson.
He can Mr. Chairman, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says Minnesota has the 11th best litigation climate for companies in the country, and we have consistently been in the top 10. We are currently at 11th, and the law in Minnesota on what a stale claim is has been 6 years since 1841.
Representative Wardlow.
Number 11 isn't as good as number 1.
With pleasure, the chair lays this bill over. All right, Representative Cornish, you're up. Last bill on the calendar this morning, House File 1467. All right, before you start, I think we have some amendments that we need to consider. But first of all, the chair would like to know who in this audience is present and wants to testify on this bill, either for or against. Raise your hand now. Approximately 8 people. We are going to vote on this bill by 10 o'clock. So I will limit to testimony. I'd like you to proceed. I think you have an author's amendment, possibly. So move the bill first and then get to your amendment. Please.
Mr. Chair and members, what I'd like to do is, as you'll see, during the amendments, we're going to take out parts that would send this to Ways and Means because of a fiscal note. So I would like to move House File 1467 be recommended to pass and move to the general register.
All right, the bill is before us. Amendments.
Mr. Chair and members, if you take out your new, what was the A4
Hang
amendment?
Hang on, Representative. Representative Hilstrom, did you have a process question?
Mr. Chair, I just want to know if there was a fiscal note done or if one exists. Or
Mr. Chair, I think there was a preliminary fiscal note.
Yep, Mr. Chair and members, there is a preliminary fiscal note. That's not complete, but it does say that there would be the only agency that reported a cost is the Department of Human Services, and they reported a cost for one full-time employee to do the reporting requirements.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was the court requested to do a fiscal note given the new standard for the court in section five, starting on line 5.3 on through 5.16?
Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, the court was listed on the fiscal note and they did not provide any information.
All right, Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the new A4 amendment, I believe, is now quoted A11-0425.
All right, we have that. Go ahead.
And if I could incorporate one small change in there on that amendment, on line 1.4, after the 2, put a semicolon and the word and. So semicolon and right after the 2 on 1.4.
All right, if there's no objection, that will be incorporated in your amendment, 0425. Now move your amendment.
I'd like to move the A11-0425 onto 1467 to get in the proper form. I'd like it.
Very good. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, would you... could I offer the amendments now to have research explain the amendments that would take the fiscal portion out of the 1467, or would you like to do that after?
Let's do it now. Go ahead.
If I could ask Mr. Diebel to explain the author's amendment that would remove any fiscal possibility out of the bill.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we just passed the oral amendment, and we didn't pass House or the amendment 0425. So are these oral amendments to the 0425, or are we going to pass this amendment then do the others?
We just passed 0425 with an incorporated amendment.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, have an amendment here that if you believe it's too long, we can have it copied and distributed, but I'll read it to you and you let me know. The motion would be to amend House File 1467 as follows. Page 2, lines 5 to 7, delete the new language.
Anything else?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Page 3, delete Section 6.
Go ahead.
And finally, page 5, delete lines 3 to 15.
Anybody have any questions on that? That would be an oral motion, Representative Cornish?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Can we get a repeat of that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Diebel, Mr. Diebel, run through that again, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. On page 2, lines 5 to 7, delete the new language. Page 3, delete Section 6. And page 5, delete lines 3 to 15.
Any questions on the motion? Mr. Diebel, give us your comment on the impact of this amendment should it prevail.
Mr. Chair and members, the first amendment on page 2 is deleting one of the provisions that the Department of Human Services had identified as causing a fiscal impact relating to gathering and conveying past mental health information to the state and federal background check systems. The second amendment on page 3, deleting Section 6, is a reporting requirement that would have been imposed on the Department of Human Services. And again, that was one of the grounds on which they based a fiscal note. And then the third amendment on page 5, lines 3 to 15, would remove some language that would establish cause of actions for those who are grieved by having their firearms repossessed, for lack of a better word, by law enforcement. And so it would remove any potential fiscal impact on the courts from them enduring or having to accept additional causes of action.
Representative Cornish, I take it you want to so move the language we just heard. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, let's do the following. I'd like you to take a few minutes, Representative Cornish, and present, and I'll take a look at the clock and determine how much time we have for testimony pro and then con, and we will discuss it and vote on it before 10, by 10 o'clock. Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I would like to share the presentation. It wouldn't be the support portion, but it would be the walkthrough of the bill with Professor Olson. I'll just give a couple of two-minute introduction and then let him do a section-by-section walkthrough. Mr. Chair and members, what you have in front of you is a number of different names have been attached to House File 1467, the Stand Your Ground, Castle Doctrine. We'd like to call it the Self-Defense Bill.
Representative Cornish, it's 9:20. I'd like you to take 15 minutes for your presentation and all pro testimony. Then we will go to contra testimony for the following 15 minutes. Then we will discuss and vote by 10 o'clock. So you have 15 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, it probably wouldn't take Professor Olson and I that long, but I know you appreciate brevity. This main section of the bill, Stand Your Ground, what this will be is an attempt to give more latitude to the homeowner or to somebody in their car, or overnight abode or tent or whatever, more latitude in action that he or she might take in defense of their person and property. We, instead of now in the justifiable homicide of having to wait for a felony committed in your presence or to be a fear of great bodily harm, we reduce the level of harm associated with that and give the citizen more choice. Contrary to what you might hear in the opposition, this does not allow you to shoot somebody toilet papering your tree or shoot the mailman, as was testified to, without any cause. Or it doesn't allow you to shoot out of your window into the darkness without being held accountable, some of the claims that were made. It's a common sense self-defense, been vetted probably more in the media than it has here in the legislature. Everybody probably is familiar with this section, and Professor Olson will shortly go through this section by section. Another piece in here, however, we're taking some part of out of that, is the reporting requirement. We would like to leave that in the bill, but we'd like to come back with that possibly later when we sort through the fiscal note on the reporting requirements. Another provision of the bill is to extend the handgun permit to purchase from 1 year to 5 years duration, similar to the permit to carry. We think it just makes common sense. A person just gets a permit and all of a sudden it's expired and you have to go through that whole rigmarole again and spend money. And so what we would like to do is the permit to purchase. We're not getting rid of any of the background checks. We're just extending it from 1 to 5 years, and with the periodical, as you'll see in the bill, electronic background checks during that time. And we would be willing to look at something in the future about tracking as far as similar to the permit to purchase, or excuse me, the permit to carry. We don't want to reduce any protection we have now from bad people getting guns, so we're just working with the duration. Another section of the bill is the emergency powers, and what this means in layman's language is we want to establish when a law enforcement can or cannot seize your firearm. And contrary again to popular belief, this does not prohibit the law enforcement from taking your firearm. There's very broad language in there talking about ongoing investigation, and with my 36 years of law enforcement, I can't figure a time hardly when I left the scene just about any crime or disturbance that there wasn't an ongoing investigation of possible charges. And so we feel that's broad language. People can still take firearms to protect the officer, to protect the public, and we just want more accountability. Right now there are firearms sitting in lockers across the state with no crimes being charged, and in fact I've worked on a couple of them with no explanation or process to get the firearm back, and it sits there with no charges pending. And so we want to try to rectify that, similar to the rumors you heard in the media about Katrina when they went down in a huge national emergency like that and just loaded up guns without any court order. We want to prohibit that from happening. And with that brief introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Professor Olson, that would walk through the bill, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
That's fine, Mr. Olson. Identify yourself, and there's roughly 11 minutes left for proponents.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm obviously not here on their behalf. I'm also president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance of Minnesota, and I'm speaking in that capacity as their registered lobbyist. And at the moment, I'm acting solely as an aide to Representative Cornish. The bill has four articles. The first article deals with permits to purchase and background checks. The initial sections in Article 1 are designed to fill some of the holes that the law enforcement people showed us earlier this session in testimony on another bill. There's information that should be going to the national background check system, which is not. And this bill will provide a mechanism to get that information there. It includes pretrial diversion program information, which is already treated as a disposition in Minnesota and is already on MNSIS, so it's just a computer transfer. The same thing is true of the information with regard to those certain gross misdemeanors that have a preclusive effect on the ownership of firearms. That data is in MNSIS. It's already on the computer system. The investigation provision simply puts in language which is already in other laws, and it provides that the sheriff must conduct the check at least yearly. It does not limit how often the checks can be conducted, but they must be conducted at least yearly. Permits are extended to 5 years. But remember, there is an annual background check behind that permit. There is a provision for petitions for hearings. We are making this provision consistent with the mirror image provision in Section 624.71.32. There are two ways to purchase a firearm. One is through a transferee permit. The other one is through a report of transfer. We noticed on the relief provisions they weren't congruent. This makes them that way. The reporting requirement in Section 6 has been taken out. Article 2 deals with authority to seize weapons. As amended, if the officer is acting under a warrant for an arrest warrant or a search warrant, this provision doesn't apply. This only applies when the officer is acting without a warrant, and it provides that he may, in fact, disarm individuals under the Terry case for officer safety. But when you are through with the encounter, the officer must return the items unless the individual is taken into physical custody. He can be taken into physical custody because he's committed a crime, or he can be taken into physical custody for a 72-hour hold for mental and physical observation. That's in the amendment. There is a provision that deals with actions by local governmental units, essentially, that would be picking out firearms businesses and dealing with them. You'll note that if you look at the amendment, section clause 4 has been amended, and it now only applies if the closing is ordered during a declared state of emergency, closing applies equally to all forms of commerce. So if you have a law that at the moment deals with pawn shops in your community, that would only be overcome by this provision in the case of a state of emergency. The relief provisions have been taken out. Article 3 deals with self-defense. I think the most important thing to notice here is the existing current law is the 75 words that are stricken on page 5.2 to 5.25. That language reappears on page 6 at line 21 through 28. So the same language has been moved. It has been clarified a bit, I will get to that in just a moment. Of the definition of deadly force is taken from the Model Penal Code. From the Model Penal Code, and it is virtually identical to the definition that affects Minnesota police officers in the next section. The dwelling definition has been extended a bit to include all places where an individual might seek safety and security. Forcible felony includes those felonies which are likely to produce bodily harm. And as I pointed out, the essence of this provision is in Subdivision 2, and it continues existing law. Let's talk about Article 4 for a moment. Article 4 recognizes carry permits from other states. It actually will require the Department of Public Safety to do less work. The significant part of this is lines 8.17 through 8.19. An individual who is prohibited from possessing a firearm in Minnesota can't bring one here. They can't use one to shoot skeet. And if they have a carry permit, it's not effective in this state. So anyone who would be prohibited from owning a firearm in Minnesota is prohibited, even if they have a permit from another state. This is necessary because Minnesota law in several respects is much more onerous with regard to restrictions than the law in other states. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have only one person here that I'm going to bring up to testify in support, and then we can move on.
Bring the person forward.
There we go. I don't know his name yet, but we believe that the majority of the Minnesotans are in support of the bill, but there wasn't enough time to bring them all in and testify.
Well, in the 3 minutes remaining, I don't think 5 million witnesses would be appropriate. State your name and go ahead.
My name is Donovan Keel. I'm a firearm instructor approved by the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. I had 5 minutes worth of speech. I'll condense it down to less than 60 seconds here. I believe that this bill in front of us strengthens the Minnesota self-defense law. What I was going to be presenting in detail, and I'll summarize, there's publicly information available both on the FBI website and on the Minnesota website, Minnesota BCA, that supports that the more people that are being responsible with guns, the less crime there is. This bill strengthens the self-defense law, and as a result of that, it does bring crime down. That's a very short summary of my presentation, but the data that I gathered, like I said, was from both the FBI website and also from the Minnesota BCA website as well. And a short note on people who sometimes come up and ask me, well, who is it getting these guns anyway? Do you have any rednecks coming in? I've never had a redneck in my class yet or anything like that. The people who do come in taking the class to get a permit to carry are generally age 50 to 59, the second group, 40 to 49, and 60 to 69. They are business owners, fathers, mothers, and veterans. They're very responsible people who come in to get a permit. I believe that this bill does strengthen our Minnesota law, self-defense law, and I believe that would help reduce crime and thereby reduce court costs as well. Thank you.
Very good. We're going to go to opposition testimony. I note that Representative Maylene has three potential amendments. We'll take those up after opposition testimony, and then we'll discuss and proceed to conclude. All those wanting to testify in opposition, first raise your hand. I do see, first of all, Heather Martins will be first, Dennis Flaherty, Minnesota Police Peace Officers Association, and then there's a Jacob Fry. These people have come forward. These people have identified themselves. Ms. Martins, come forward. Okay. Is there anyone else who I haven't named wants to be heard in opposition? All right, there'll be 15 minutes, so whoever's going first, proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name, for the record, is Dennis Flaherty. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a group of about 8,500 rank and file officers in our state. I would like to just make some very brief comments in opposition to the bill. I will just speak quickly on four articles, and I probably would speak on other ones, but the bill is only four articles. First of all, our concern is with this five-year permit and the fact that there's nothing in there that requires the permit holder to notify the law enforcement agency that issued it when they move. So let's say in year two or year three the annual check comes up and shows that there's some disqualifying thing now on the individual's record. We have nothing but the address, that the original address. We can send something to them, but if they've long moved, they can continue on for the duration of the validity of the permit and continue to buy handguns even though they're ineligible to do so. And we find that strange that you would not want to require that law enforcement be made aware of any address changes. Secondly, in the second article about relieving people from firearms, I just want you to know the net effect of what's going to happen here. Quite frequently, officers go into people's homes in domestic situations or at times when people are not mentally stable. And there may be firearms present or the threat of firearms. And oftentimes, in an effort to protect these individuals, we will take the weapons, property inventory them at the police station, and hold them until things quiet down, and then they're returned to them. You remove that from us, remove that ability, and it's surely oftentimes it makes a huge difference, and it makes a difference between whether there is a firearm-related incident in that home or not. I'm going to skip to Article 4, the permits from every state. I don't know why we would want to just say that any permit issued in America is valid in Minnesota when so many states do not have the same standards that we have. I've heard Representative Cornish on several times talk about the bill that was passed, the permit to carry, and how well it's working. Well, I think that's largely because law enforcement helped ensure that there were enough safeguards in there that only, you know, their real efforts to make sure only the right people get these permits to carry. I would think we would not want to just turn around and willy-nilly let every person that just simply gets one off an internet to carry a permit. And then lastly, the Article 3 on the Castle Doctrine portion of it. It talks in there about entering homes by force or stealth. Let me tell you, every day, somewhere in this state, in suburbs, urban areas, rural areas, cops are going on somebody's property, often without invitation, and they may be executing arrest warrants, search warrants, no-knock warrants, and they are going into people's homes by force and stealth. And we are, to us, this is a huge officer safety issue. With that, I'll turn it over to the Chiefs Association.
Good morning. Identify yourself and go ahead.
I'm Dave Peacher, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We represent over 330 law enforcement agencies throughout the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill. I'd also like to, for your consideration, to submit letters from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and from James Backstrom, County Attorney of Dakota County, as additional evidence in opposition of this bill. My testimony will be very brief, as the details of our opposition are contained in those letters. First of all, Article 1, supporting Mr. Flaherty's stand on that, and I would like to add the additional information that, according to BCA, approximately only 25% of the permit holders renew annually, reapply annually. So by having a five-year permit and the annual checks, that will be an additional cost to law enforcement. In Article 2, the authority to seize and confiscate firearms. Having heard the testimony that this is based on the Katrina event, it's hard to transfer what allegedly happened between the citizens of government and the police in New Orleans could transfer here to Minnesota. Having said that, the language of this article appears to be overly broad, confusing, and also affects local control when it comes to zoning issues and land control. Also, Article 3 in the self-defense, as Mr. Flaherty also talked about, we oppose the expanded definition of the dwelling, the circumstances when deadly force is authorized, the retreat provision, the burden of proof, and the presumptions as authorized by this article. And finally, in Article 4, the recognition of other states' permits to carry, we do see this as an opportunity to circumvent the current Minnesota law in that our training standards are much more stringent than many states, and it's currently working by having the reciprocity agreements with other states that closely match our existing state statute. So therefore, we would oppose any opportunity to recognize state permits that do not are not part of the reciprocity agreement. Thank you.
Thank you. Additional testimony in opposition. Give us your name and go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jared Jordahl, the Legislative Director for the Department of Public Safety. I, too, will be very brief. I wanted to comment specifically on Article 4, the permit reciprocity. As the previous testifier said, we do reciprocity with other states for carry permits is handled by the Department of Public Safety under state law. We're to assess whether other states' laws are substantially similar in their issuance requirements. That has resulted in us having reciprocity with 15 other states around the country, meaning Minnesota recognizes permits issued in 15 other states. We look at various parameters, most particularly alcohol disabilities and mental health commitments. We just feel that the existing system is one that works and is safeguarding Minnesotans, and we don't see cause to change it at this point and have universal recognition of permits.
Very good. Any other opposition testimony? Step forward. If you'd give us your name and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Heather Martens. I'm Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. I'm here to testify against this bill. I wanted to start just by responding to a couple of statements that have been made. The claims that the shoot first section of this bill will not result in the shooting of innocent people. This is not true. If you change the definition of someone's home to include the curtilage, which is all the area around the home, and anyone entering by stealth or by force meaning the amount of force necessary to open a doorknob or to push on an unlatched gate, you are opening up justifiable use of deadly force against people who intend no harm. There is a presumption in the bill that says anyone who has entered the domicile by stealth or by force is presumed to intend to do harm, and therefore they would be subject to deadly force. One example given in earlier testimony was from Jim Backstrom, who stated that one example of this would be a teenager going into somebody's garage to steal a bicycle, and that person would be subject to being shot. To me, that says if you adopt that standard, then you are placing the value of property above the value of life. And that makes a statement about our society. Also, I wanted to respond to another statement earlier that said the presence of more guns or more people carrying guns in our society brings down crime. That statement has been refuted by the National Academy of Sciences in a comprehensive review of the data in 2004. They reviewed, including John Lott's data, and found that there is no evidence that the increased carrying of guns by individuals reduces crime. And in Minnesota, since the law passed, there have been 711 non-traffic-related crimes committed by people who do have permits to carry. By comparison, there have been a handful of self-defense incidents. That was not how it was supposed to be, according to the proponents of that. So I think that's important to point out. At the time, we also heard that people who would be carrying guns would be subject to very strict requirements on when they could actually fire that gun. But this changes all that. It changes the standards so that there's no longer a reasonableness standard. And it has it's likely to have unintended consequences like those that we've seen in Texas and Florida. I want to give you an example from Texas where it changes how someone on someone else's property is treated. Carter Albrecht, 34, a popular and charming Dallas musician, mixed a prescription smoking cessation drug with alcohol and began to act erratically, scaring his girlfriend. He left his house and began pounding on the neighbor's door. The neighbor fired a warning shot through the door, shooting Albrecht in the head and killing him. Shoot first meant that this shooter was not charged. I don't think that's an appropriate treatment of someone who cannot harm another person. There's a second case from Florida. In March 2006, decorated Army veteran Michael Frazzini was shot and killed outside his house by neighbor Todd Rasmussen. Rasmussen stated that he shot Frazzini because he was lunging at his son Corey, who was armed with a knife and who has a lengthy criminal record, including violent offenses. Frazzini was armed with a small souvenir baseball bat. No charges were brought against Todd Rasmussen. These are some of the unintended consequences that this bill would have. And I think what you'll see is not necessarily more, you know, large numbers of people suddenly starting to kill, but people who do kill doing so with impunity. And that's what I'd like to say.
Any additional testimony? Give us your name and proceed, and you've got approximately 3 minutes, max.
Yes, my name is Jacob Fry. I'm an attorney licensed with the state and federal bars. And I'm also very familiar with death penalty cases, as I've tried one, and in the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And I'm quite familiar with the practical realities of the law, and I can tell you that the practical realities of this bill is that it doesn't work. I've heard a lot of testimony for proponents of this bill, and it's becoming quite evident that the proponents aren't clear what the present law is. So I'll lay out an example. It's 8 o'clock at night, and you're sitting with your family, your wife and your children watching television, when suddenly an intruder enters. Under the present law, and I'll repeat, under the present law, you can shoot the intruder in the face. That is the present law. Now, we're looking to go one step beyond that and eliminate the reasonable criteria. I mean, this is a tenet in law school. It's you're asking whether the individual who shot was acting reasonable, was being a reasonable person under the circumstances. There are zero circumstances. There are zero cases out there where a self-defense claim has failed under these circumstances. Not a single one. Yet still, for some reason, we're proposing this bill. What essentially we're saying is we don't care what the reasonable person would do under the circumstances, because this bill creates a presumption that the shooter acted like a reasonable person even when he acted like a complete idiot. This is not right. This is not the kind of behavior that the Minnesota legislature should be promoting, and this is not the law we want our judicial branch to uphold. And also, just to be clear, this presumption is not rebuttable because it involves a person's subjective perception. If the shooter says, "I believe the intruder was going to seriously injure me," how do you rebut that? The only way you can rebut that is, "No, you didn't." That's it. And you certainly can't ask the victim at this point. You certainly ask because he's dead. There's really no way of rebutting this presumption. Furthermore, Representative Cornish is correct that this bill does not allow someone to shoot just randomly out in the dark. But if they do decide to shoot out randomly in the dark and they happen to hit a trespasser, there is a presumption that the shooter acted reasonably. It is presumed. Just to provide some other examples, under the proposed bill, if you shoot the neighborhood kid who sneaks up onto your deck while playing hide-and-go-seek, while stealthily playing hide-and-go-seek, I might add, there's no problem.
If you could proceed to conclude, please.
There's no problem because you are presumed to have acted reasonably. For those kids, for those of you that have kids, you know that sometimes they make stupid decisions, and when they do so, they should be punished, but the punishment for making a stupid decision is not death. This is not our Minnesota. We are better than that. I stand in firm opposition to this bill, along with Virginia and Wyoming, which are both friendly gun states.
I want to thank you both and every person here who's testified. We're going to go to other amendments. Representative Maylene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would withdraw the A1 amendment and then ask if we could hear the A3 amendment before the A2 amendment.
Representative Maylene moves the A3 amendment. Representative Cornish, we're running out of time. Have a seat at the table, please. Discussion on the amendment. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe Mr. Olson will give a very short...
Do you accept this amendment or do you not?
No. A3. Is that correct?
Which one are we on, Mr. Right Chairman?
A3.
A3.
Representative Maleen, why don't you? They don't seem to be ready. Would you proceed to tell us,
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Under current law, if you do shoot another individual, you are required to render aid pursuant to Minnesota Statute 609.662. I was told by staff that this statute would already apply to Representative Cornish's bill. I just thought that it was important to cross-reference it for clarity purposes.
Reaction.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mellon, the 609.662 does apply, and we don't believe it's necessary to have a cross-reference.
Discussion on the amendment. Hearing none, those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Next amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that that one was going to pass, but we'll go to the A2.
Representative Maleen moves the A2 amendment. To tell us what it does.
The A2 amendment changes the word honestly on line 6.35, which is subdivision 3, degree of force, retreat. It changes the word honestly to reasonably. And I felt that this was a necessary change because the word honestly actually isn't found in our criminal code. I did print off where that word is found, and it's found in some banking statutes and other, but it's not found in our criminal code. And if you look at subdivision 2, circumstances when authorized, subdivision 2.1, to resist or prevent the commission of a felony in the individual's dwelling, there's actually no reasonableness standard if you do use deadly force when there is a commission of a felony in the individual's dwelling. And as Professor Olson has stated, that is actually current law. However, the meaning of the words has changed substantially under Representative Cornish's bill, including the meaning of the word dwelling has really expanded substantially. And so because of that, I thought that it is appropriate to use the word reasonable instead of honestly.
Representative Cornish, do you support or do you not support the amendment?
I don't support the amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I think the amendment is misdrafted. Representative Maleen said line 35, and the amendment says line 33, if I'm looking at the right thing.
Mr. Diebel, is that correct? If no one objects, we'll incorporate that change. Thank you. On the amendment, any discussion? If not, those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any further amendments? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 3.26 and 3.27, this is where they discuss granting attorney's fees. Mr. Chair, I believe that if this stays in the bill, it would be appropriate for me to make a motion to send this to civil law, so I would encourage the author to take it out if he doesn't want to go to civil law.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd rather not send it to civil law. I don't believe that requires it, and they haven't asked for it. So at this point, I would like to move it to my previous motion to the General Register.
The motion before us is that it be... Sorry. You have your moving to amend.
To delete those lines so that it really doesn't need to go to...
Representative Hillstrom moves the amendment as stated. Representative Cornish, your reaction again, please.
I would oppose the amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Motion is before us that the bill be recommended to pass. Any other amendments?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Maleen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just ask the author one question?
Please.
Representative Cornish, I spoke on the phone this morning to Gordon Ramsey, who's the chief of police of Duluth, and he expressed strong opposition to the bill, a lot of the concerns that were already expressed by law enforcement today. But one thing that he did bring to my attention is that with the five-year permit changes, that now every year within those 5 years, local law enforcement will have to do a background check. Whereas under current law, if somebody just buys one firearm and they don't want the five-year permit, they would just have to do the one background check initially. And he was concerned with increased costs and staff time to do those background checks every year. Could you just comment on that a little bit?
Mr. Chair and members, my comment would be that this actually strengthens the bill rather than wait for 5 years to do it each year. They should be more than anxious to do that if you want more protection from people not being able to buy in case their status changes. And we don't believe that there would be a fiscal note to this because it's electronic backgrounds check available at their fingertips. So I think they're just over-exaggerating the cost on this background check. All the information should be available for the NCIS and or not, the NICS check or the National Crime Information Center. We think there's enough information available to them in that electronic check where they should be able to weed them out.
Representative Maylene.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, would you be willing to accept an amendment that that if there is an increased cost in background checks, the state and not local units of government would have to absorb those costs?
Representative Cornish, your response?
Representative, I'd be interested in talking about it, but not amending at this time because it would be hard to figure out a vague amendment like that. And, but I'd sure be interested in talking to you about it and talking to you about the real cost of what it would be. But at this point, it would be hard to make an amendment to those words.
All right, the motion before us, Representative Hillstrom, the motion before us is that this bill, House File 1467, as amended, be recommended to pass, go to the General Register. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I pointed out with the motion to delete lines 3.26 and 3.27, creating attorney's fees allowed to be granted, this bill really should go to civil law. In addition, on lines 7.26, it puts in immunity from civil liability. Mr. Chair, those are two issues that are clearly within the jurisdiction of the Civil Law Committee. I was under the impression that those two previous lines were going to be deleted, and so I wasn't even going to bring up the immunity from civil liability piece. But given that is the case, I believe it is appropriate that this bill go to civil law and they do their due diligence on the bill, Mr. Chair. And so that is my motion to move it to civil law.
All right, the motion.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom moves to amend the motion on the floor that it be referred instead of the General Register to the Committee on Civil Law. A couple of thoughts. It's my understanding that the chairman of civil law has taken a look at this bill and has declined to notify us of wanting to see the bill. Representative Cornish, we're going to vote on this motion. Do you have something you would choose to say?
Actually, I've been informed we don't need that. So, Representative Hillstrom, if you would like to offer the amendment on what you specifically talked about there on the immunity, that would be fine.
You There's want a motion that before amendment? Us right now. Representative Hillstrom, are you prepared to vote on your motion to amend?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Or would you like to withdraw it?
I'll withdraw my amendment, Mr. Chair. If, again, you're going to accept the lines 3.26 amendment, I would make that motion, or I would withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish, where are we at?
Mr. Diebel, if he could explain what the amendment we have to do to accomplish this task.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, if I'm tracking the conversation, the amendment would be on page 3, line 26, delete everything after the period, the second period, and then delete page 3, line 27, delete line 27.
Representative Hillstrom and Representative Cornish, do you understand that, or do you both agree? Representative Cornish.
No, this isn't the amendment we were talking about, the Representative or Chairman Smith. The last amendment you talked about was in a different portion of the bill. This is attorney's fees here.
I've been talking about attorney's fees.
Award the attorney's fees.
Yeah, the award of attorney's fees. That's
well, we would oppose that amendment. I was talking about the other amendment you talked about just when you recently mentioned in a different portion of the bill, the immunity.
Oh, the civil immunity?
Yeah.
Delete that out?
That's the one I was talking about.
I'd be fine with deleting out the civil immunity. I'm fine with that.
Representative Cornish, do you have a motion?
Well, I'd like to defeat this motion and amend first, unless she wants to withdraw it. We were talking about two different amendments. The second one that you brought up about the immunity is the one that we'd accept.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom, do you have a motion or do you not?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to renew my motion that the proper place is for this to go to civil law. There are two provisions in here that are civil law related.
Okay,
I'm just going to renew that motion.
Thank you. Representative Hilstrom moves to amend the motion on the table that this bill go to civil law. Hearing no discussion, those in favor of the motion to amend signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Motion is before us. Any further discussion? If not, on the motion, the bill be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register?
Yes.
On that motion, any discussion? Seeing none, those all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank
all right,
you,
no further business to come before us today. I think we're going to adjourn. Thank you.